Good morning. May it please the court.
Yes.
This case addresses two issues. First, the trial court plainly erred in sentencing Mr. Pierce because the trial court had a materially false understanding of the possible range of punishment available. And second, the trial court erred in overruling Mr. Pierce's motion to suppress evidence. I am planning to focus mainly on the range of punishment issue, but of course, if the court would like to address the suppression issue, please obviously feel free to guide me with your questions. It is clear in this case the judge misunderstood the range of punishment. Mr. Pierce was charged with a B felony, whose range of punishment was 5 to 15 years in the Department of Corrections. But because Mr. Pierce was found to be a prior and persistent offender, the maximum range increased to 30 years, resulting in a range of punishment of 5 to 30. The court, however, misunderstood this enhancement and instead stated in the record that the range of punishment as enhanced was 10 to 30. The parties had previously agreed on a lid of 20, which added more to this, in exchange for Mr. Pierce waiving his right to jury trial. And ultimately, Mr. Pierce was sentenced to 15 years in the Department of Corrections. Mr. Pierce has a fundamental due process right to have the correct range of punishment considered when his liberty is taken away. Due process demands this. This issue essentially boils down to a fundamental separation of powers issue. The legislature provides the framework for the range of punishment through applicable statutes. It is then the judiciary's job to sentence a defendant using that framework. First, for the court to use an incorrect range of punishment means the court is failing to follow the legislature's intent in considering the entire range of punishment when passing sentence. Second, within the judicial system itself, there is a tier system that applies, and it was established by the Constitution that the trial judge, and only the trial judge, determines a defendant's sentence. This is not an issue for an appellate court. It is not for the appellate court to decide a defendant's sentence or to interfere with the trial judge's sentencing determination. This court drew a hard line and distinction between the role of the appellate court and the trial court in State v. Porter. In Porter, this court ruled that the appellate court is not to be a super juror and engage in credibility determinations that are left or that are supposed to be left to judges and juries who are the trier of fact. Neither are appellate judges sentencing judges. And that's the issue that this case raises. Respondent has argued that appellant was not effectively sentenced, as a prior and persistent offender because the sentence that he ultimately received, 15 years, falls within the original unenhanced range of punishment. Because of this, respondent argues appellant did not suffer manifest injustice. However, as you know, under the plain error review, we look at two prongs. First, the actual error, which is easily apparent in this case. But the second, that a miscarriage of justice occurred, it is just as apparent in this case. When a defendant is sentenced pursuant to a materially false understanding of the correct range of punishment, it's a clear violation of that defendant's rights, regardless of the outcome that courts have repeatedly found. One of the more recent examples that I thought of very late last night was actually the Basil case, which is quite a fun one in my office. This court determined that the proper remedy was to remand the case back to the trial court for resentencing when it determined that certain stealing cases were not felonies but misdemeanors. This court did not demand that all cases be lowered to the maximum allowed sentence for a misdemeanor of 1 year. Instead, this court said we need to have this each case looked at for resentencing because there may be factors that were not considered now that it's considered a misdemeanor that would encourage a court to give a defendant less than 1 year. That's one of the more recent that I've come up with, but there are many, many examples of scenarios where a plain error was found in sentencing specifically by this court, by lower courts, that then resulted in a manifest injustice merely because the error itself existed.
Opposing counsel says that because the trial judge gave a number of specific reasons related to the facts of the case, that negates any prejudice or presumption that it would have changed the sentence had he known what the real lower floor was.
Absolutely, and that's actually a great segue into my
great
next
anticipation.
Point. Thank you. The sentencing judge himself said that our society demands punishment for certain crimes, and society's demand in that punishment is basically written out in the range of punishment that is provided
well, there's
to
no,
us.
There's no disagreement that this is within the range. The disagreement or the reasonable debate is whether there's manifest injustice and whether or not the record in this case supports the fact that the trial judge took into consideration valid factors other than what the minimum was. Right? He didn't stop it at 10, at the misspoken minimum. He was above that. He was kind of halfway between the range, and he was very particular about the things that he considered when he decided to pronounce the sentence. So what is there that even suggests in this record that the defendant would get a different sentence?
Well, it's interesting that you use the phrase halfway between that, because that's the thought that I constantly have in my head about this particular case. What if the judge did say, I'm going to go halfway between? I'm thinking that the minimum is 10.
Well, you'd certainly have a stronger case.
Well, absolutely.
The factors that he's set forth didn't really talk about what the maximum or minimum were.
Well, we're not also arguing that, or I would maintain that just because the judge gives us many reasons, it's not an exclusive list, that there are not other reasons in the back of his head, or that he just didn't explain to the court or to the defendant
well,
during
and
this
he,
time.
And he did specifically say the range here is 10 to 30, right? No, judge, it's 10 to 20 because of the lid that we did. And then
correct.
He said he'd do 15. So it was clearly in the judge's mind.
That's correct. And if we're looking at a halfway point, of course, 5 to 20 divided in half would result in a lesser sentence than the 10 to 20. But of course, we don't know that that was the judge's rationale, and that's actually the point. The judge does give us a number of reasons, but he doesn't quantify those reasons. He doesn't say, I think that this reason is worth 2 years, and this reason is worth three more than that, and this reason is worth another number, and then all of that's going to total up to 15. One of the things he does say, and this is in the transcript on page 275, when he talks about my client's risk and risk of or his ability to be rehabilitated, he says, you're not a great candidate for rehabilitation. You're a poor candidate for rehabilitation. Excuse me, you're not a poor candidate for rehabilitation, but you're right smack dab right in the middle. And that's kind of where I see you as well. And I think that gives us a guide as well. He is saying here, smack dab in the middle, that's where I see you. And then when we look at what the ultimate sentence was, right smack dab in the middle between 10 and 20. Additionally, we need to look at what the judge didn't say. In State v. Seton, the judge said, I'm going to try and send a little message to the people in the Department of Corrections that at least I think the crime you committed is very, very serious, and I think the punishment should be very severe. This is not a situation where the judge said, I think you should serve the maximum, or I think that there shouldn't be any answer, any question into how harsh I'm going to sentence you. The phrase we have from the judge is, society expects a pretty harsh punishment, but then he follows up with a 15-year sentence as opposed to the maximum allowed under the lid, which is 20. So he's saying society expects it, but he's not saying I am giving you the harshest sentence that I can, which is why this case is easily distinguishable from Seton. Additionally, we have the State v. Elam, which is a case where manifest injustice was not found. And in that case, the court gave us three different factors that it looked into. Of course, I can't find my card with those factors right now. But the third is what's relevant. The third is that the court gave no indication in Elam that he was considering the incorrect range of punishment. But in our case, we know he was, because he said so. He said, and this enhances the range to 10 to 30. And it's based on that that we are requesting, at least based on that issue, resentencing. Of course, we're also requesting that this case be remanded back for a new trial based on the suppression issue, Regarding the suppression issue, the court erred in overruling Mr. Pierce's. Before I move on, actually, are there any other questions about the range of punishment? I guess I should ask it that way. Okay, fantastic. Regarding the suppression issue, the court erred in overruling Mr. Pierce's motion to suppress, finding that it occurred after a non-consensual search, but the trial court found that it was a search that was conducted under the exigent circumstances exception to the Fourth Amendment. The court correctly found, in our opinion, that Mr. Pierce did not knowingly or intellectually consent to a search of his house, frankly, because he couldn't, because he
and
was
you,
in...
Would you agree with me that that is a finding of Mr. Pierce's subjective thinking?
I don't know that I would agree with that.
Okay. Well,
I think under an objective standard, it's also a situation where we have a person who is saying, my cat is telling me to kill myself, and that anyone hearing that, a reasonable officer hearing that, should know this person is not right in his mind. Therefore, he cannot intelligently balance the factors that he needs to balance before he agrees to let us walk through his home and search it. So no, I would not agree.
Is that a decision for us to make, or is that something for remand to the trial court, which, as you're saying, we should do on the sentence, to make a determination of could an officer in good faith have thought they had consent?
Well, actually, I do believe that a good faith determination is essentially a credibility determination, and so that would be something for the trial court to determine, not for an appellate court, and arguably not for this court either. The idea, though, didn't come to me until last week, so it was not honestly raised in my brief that that should be the remedy to that. I will say the idea of good faith was not brought up in this case until the Western District's opinion, which found that the court was wrong, that this was not an exigent circumstance that allowed for the search, but instead that it was allowed under the good faith exception. But that does not apply here either. Officers testified that they offered Mr. Pierce peace of mind through a search of his home. To believe testimony that the officers felt he needed peace of mind also means that you have to believe that he honestly thought that there was a threat in his house from his cat telling him to kill himself. And with that, my time is coming to an end, and I will be back shortly. Thank you.
May it please the court. Missouri case law holds that plain error and manifest injustice are fact-specific inquiries. For example, the Southern District Van Loo case stated, the outcome of plain error review depends heavily on the specific facts and circumstances of each case. This court in Baxter stated, manifest injustice is determined by the facts and circumstances of the case, and the defendant bears the burden of establishing manifest injustice. So here, the defendant had the burden to demonstrate manifest injustice under the specific facts of this case. There was no manifest injustice for a couple of reasons. The first I'll point out is that nothing in the record demonstrated any improper reliance. There's no indication that the defendant was actually sentenced as a persistent offender. For example, the judgment itself makes no mention that there was a persistent offender finding. The court never mentioned the defendant's status as a persistent offender during the remainder of sentencing, or when issuing the sentence, or when explaining the numerous factors that it considered.
So the entire discussion, you think, was irrelevant, where the court said, what's the range here? Is it 10 to 30? Well, because he's a persistent offender, well, Your Honor, it would be, but 20 is the lid, and okay, 20, and then he talks about the sentencing. That was just puffery or something?
Well, so I don't know if I would go so far as to say that it was completely irrelevant. It's certainly a specific fact and circumstance of this case that can be considered.
What would be the range if he wasn't a persistent offender?
5 to 15 years.
And that's not the range the court referenced?
It was not the range that the court, at the very beginning of sentencing, mentioned, right? The judge said my understanding is that the range of punishment has been extended to 10 to 30 years. Is that correct?
So doesn't that make it clear from the record that he was sentencing him as a prior and persistent offender?
Under the entirety of the trial court's comments, I don't think so. First of all, when the judge made that statement, he asked, is it 10 to 30? He was basically asking, not stating, it is 10 to 30. So he was asking, and what the parties did was that they did not confirm that misunderstanding.
Are you saying he never made a finding he was a persistent offender, never said anything on the record, it wasn't proved up and conceded by the other side?
So before trial, he was proved up as a persistent offender, verbally on the record, but the judgment itself closer in time to the actual sentence that was issued. The judgment never mentions a persistent offender finding.
And if the court doesn't agree with that argument, what you have another argument that you make in your brief about why it's
Right. So, well, again, so the 10 to 30 comment, it was never confirmed by the parties. And in fact, the minimum was never confirmed either. When the judge said, is it 10 to 30, the parties ignored the minimum, did not confirm that it was 10 years, and instead simply said, we had agreed to a lid of 20. Now, the specific facts and circumstances of this case are that the court, you know, had extensive comments about the reasons it was issuing the defendant's sentence. And the court emphasized that defendant should receive a harsh punishment. And in fact, defendant received the maximum of the unenhanced B, 5 to 15. He received 15 years, which is what you would expect if the trial judge had in mind the 5 to 15 year range. And he said, defendant, society expects a harsh punishment. Defendant's crimes are very, very serious.
Do you agree with the statement by Mr. Pierce's counsel that he said he was looking at the middle range?
I disagree.
Is that in the record is my question.
So the trial court mentioned three general factors that it was considering, retribution or punishment, rehabilitation, and reoffending. So the rehabilitation was basically a wash to the trial judge. But the trial judge indicated in its language clearly that rehabilitation was not an important factor, that it was the reoffending that was the primary factor, and then also retribution, that society expects a very harsh punishment. And it's those two factors.
Why doesn't it make sense to figure out, we're discussing what must have been in the trial court's mind, let the trial court figure that out. They may exactly sentence him again to the same sentence, but why not send it back for the trial court to clarify?
Well, pursuant to plain error review, the defendant does have the burden to demonstrate manifest injustice, and under the specific facts of this case.
And once the defendant has shown confusion as to what the range of punishment was, and a misbelief if the court were to find that on the record as to what the range of punishment was, why isn't that sufficient in the absence of some showing that the trial court, for instance, in one of the cited cases, they said, I'm going to give you the maximum, I'm going to make it consecutive, but the trial court made clear it would not have had any effect. Where here, you can both point to things in the record, so the record is not leaves a question as to what the trial court would have done. Isn't the logical thing to simply remand it for the trial court to find out? Because it would be a manifest injustice if this sentence is based on a belief as to the range which was not correct.
If the sentence was based on the improper minimum, then I think that would be manifest injustice. But prejudice or errors happen all the time at the trial court level. And the large, overwhelming rule is that appellate court will not remand unless the defendant was prejudiced. And that burden is only heightened, whereas here we have plain error and manifest injustice.
What does the prior cases say regarding whether or not the trial court being mistaken as to the range of punishment is plain error?
The case law is clear that if the trial court bases the defendant's sentence based on that misunderstanding, then that will be reversed. But if instead the sentence is based on other valid considerations, it will not be reversed, particularly under a plain error review. And here we have 5.5 pages of transcript with the trial court explaining its basis for defendant's sentence, where the trial court explicitly stated that those factors were what defendant's sentence was based on, not any potential misunderstanding on the minimum.
Don't we have cases saying a sentencing court's mistaken belief about the range of punishment is a materially false foundation that entitles a defendant to resentencing?
It sounds familiar, but again, an appellate court will not reverse unless there is manifest injustice based on what the error would be. If there's error, there has to be manifest injustice based on that specific error for reversal. Now, I do want to talk again about the range of punishment. So the trial court, right, the three factors, rehabilitation, reoffending, and retribution, if, as a defendant would argue, the trial judge was thinking middle of the road, and if the trial judge was thinking 10 to 30 years, then you would expect a 20-year sentence. That's middle of the road. But defendant received a 15-year sentence, which was under the argued misunderstanding, 10 to 30. The trial judge, again, stated that rehabilitation was not an important factor in this case. It was the reoffending, particularly, and also the retribution that were driving the sentence. And the judge explicitly stated that these were awful crimes, and that's a big issue in this case. Society expects a pretty harsh punishment. Social norms are not a factor that favors well. He didn't want this to happen to future victims. It would be hard to live with himself if defendant abused another child, and that was something that, quote, sincerely concerned the judge. And so that language expresses a desire to do more than middle of the road, and that language supports the trial judge's sentence of the maximum of the unenhanced range.
What was your math again on why it wasn't the middle of the road?
If, as defendant argues, the trial court understood the range to be 10 to 30, then you would expect middle of the road to be 20 years, right between 10 to 30 for the enhanced Class A.
But, of course, that had been agreement to a lid of 20, so that wasn't available to the judge.
They did agree to a lid of 20, but the trial judge is not bound by the party's agreement. And can, if the trial judge thinks that the defendant deserves more than 20, the trial judge is free to give the full 30. But so my last point on this math is that the trial judge, again, indicated that the sentence should be very severe, very harsh. And so if the trial judge had thought of the 10 to 20, then a 15-year is at odds with the court language. But a 15-year sentence, which would be the maximum of the unenhanced range, is consistent, completely consistent with the trial judge's extensive comments.
Can you address the first issue, the suppression issue, briefly?
Sure.
What's the basis on which you're saying it was justified at this point in this court?
So my brief argues that both the defendant validly consented to the search and that the search was also justified by exigent circumstances. The Western District below found no exigent circumstances, but that the consent was valid. So I'll start with consent. The Bustamante U.S. Supreme Court case held that consent is viewed under a voluntariness standard. And so there is no need to show that a defendant was actually even aware of his rights. It's a voluntariness standard, and the court stated that the key to voluntariness is whether there was coercion.
And can someone who's suffering hallucinations consent? Can that be voluntary?
Certainly. The courts have always viewed voluntary.
Not that they have mental illness generally, but that at the time they're being sent to the hospital because they're currently suffering from hallucinations. I've never seen a case like that.
I don't recall a case under these exact circumstances, but there are cases about intoxication, which I think is similar. And here, the specific facts of this case are that even assuming that the defendant was hallucinating, was still hallucinating when the police arrived, he was still lucid and cooperative. He was able to, well, for one, even before the police arrived, he had enough awareness to understand that he thought he was in danger and that he needed to call an assistance hotline for assistance. He was able to do that. He was able to speak with the police officers when they arrived, answer all of their questions, and explain what the situation was.
Now, the consent that the defendant gave was a consent to search the house for people that might be harming him, but did that consent extend to such things as looking at what's on a computer screen or reading the mail or anything else sitting out in plain view?
Well, so the defendant's understanding was right, that the police were there to clear his residence, to make him feel safe, to make sure that he actually was safe. But the plain view
doctrine. To look for people.
Right. But the plain view doctrine, I mean, the police officers were clearing the residence, going room to room to make sure that there was no danger in any residence. And just in plain view, there was a computer that was displaying a slideshow of the images.
Did they have to touch it to make it move from the one picture?
No, Your Honor. The computer monitor was displaying a slideshow image after image.
The screensaver was a slideshow.
Right. But again, so the United States Supreme Court has instructed that consent is a voluntariness standard. The defendant does not even need to be shown that he was aware of his rights, and this voluntariness standard hinges on coercion. The defendant has argued no coercion. There is no evidence of coercion on the record. Every indication is that the police were sincerely concerned for the defendant's well-being. The defendant was distressed, and they were interested in making sure that he was safe and that he felt safe.
So how should we consider the factual finding made by the trial court with regard to the defendant's consent? Do we just ignore it, or how do we categorize it?
So I don't believe there was actually a factual finding. There was a legal conclusion that he did not give consent, but...
Well, that he wasn't able to because of his mental state, not that he didn't say you can do that.
So generally, issues on suppression issues are mixed questions of law and fact. And I think this is one of those, a mixed question of law and fact that is entitled to independent review by the appellate court.
Well, to the extent it our decision is based upon a factual determination, we would defer to the trial court on that factual determination, would we not?
That's the general rule, although we also look at the record on the light most favorable to the ruling. We'll uphold if the trial court's ruling can be upheld under any theory. And then again, mixed questions of law and fact qualify for independent review. So unless Your Honors have any additional questions, thank you.
May it please the court.
If we were to remand for resentencing, would your client be at least at risk for a sentence of 20 years or maybe even 30 years?
He would, now that he would be facing a new sentencing judge. Would argue that that would be one of the factors that could change in his particular situation. But because unless something else has happened in his case, or in his life, I guess you would say, since he was first sentenced that could be used against him, there would be no justification for giving him a higher sentence if it was the same sentencing judge that he would face.
Well, why wouldn't the... Was this plea an agreement, a binding lid of 20, or was it an agreement that the parties would not argue for anything in excess of 20?
It was a binding lid of 20. Jackson County has binding plea agreements as well as binding lids, and it was made in exchange for Mr. Pierce waiving his right to a jury trial. Mm-hmm. So in exchange for that, the parties agreed that he would face only a maximum of 20 years. And the court accepted that.
And you think the court sentenced him as a persistent offender? And that's what the sentencing hearing would be on,
yes,
remand if you were successful.
Yes, and if we look at the language that the court, I mean, the court did talk about reasons why he was sentencing Mr. Pierce, and that included his criminal history. He talked about the crimes that he had been convicted of, and of course those would come into play as relevant if he does get resentenced.
Well, so your position is on remand, he would not be at risk for a sentence higher than the one he originally received? Not 16 years, not 17 years.
Well, my position is that he would in this situation, because his sentencing judge is no longer the judge that would oversee the case, because he has a new judge who can take an entirely new view of the situation. However, if we're in a
well,
scenario...
Well, suppose the chief assigned the same judge to resentence him. You think he is bound by the prior sentence?
I think there would certainly be argument that I or that his defense attorney could make that said that under the law, and I'm not prepared with cases that support this judge, I apologize, but under the law he would not be subject to a higher sentence because there's no justification for it except possibly punishment for exercising his rights in the appeal.
And where's the justification for a lower sentence? If that number was the product of deliberate analysis, then why isn't it the product of deliberate analysis?
If I'm understanding your question correctly, why are we saying he might get less time? Is that...
No, why would you argue that he cannot get a greater sentence from the same judge, but that same judge can give a lesser sentence?
because that same judge would be taking into consideration the actual minimum sentence. And sentencing with a range of punishment is all about relativity. So it's based on a starting point, which is your minimum, and then going higher from there, or it's based on a maximum and then going lower based on the mitigation factors. But when you're looking at the range,
well, which of those occurred this time? Starting at the minimum and going up, or starting at the maximum lid and going down?
That's what we don't know, and that's why this case should be remanded back for resentencing by the trial court.
If I understand you, you're not saying legally there's a prohibition of the same judge changing the maximum sentence, but a new judge could do that, but that the judge, if the judge did as the state suggests and was considered all these things and decided 15 was the one, the judge would likely do that again because nothing new bad has happened. But the only change has been the judge now knows they can impose a lower sentence than the judge thought before it, and this judge would take that into consideration along with all the other factors the judge already considered in deciding what the appropriate sentence was.
That's correct. That when you have a different lower starting point, where you fall on the scale would theoretically also lean towards the lower. And I know my hand gestures are a little awkward, but we have the lower, right, and where we fall would be adjusted based on that.
I think under the law, your relief you're requesting is to go back for resentencing, right, and the judge isn't bound by anything other than the legal range of sentencing when the case is remanded.
And generally, I would agree with that. I'd have to go back and pull up Westlaw to go deeper into that issue, so okay. I apologize.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And thanks for a very good first argument, and thanks both of you for a good argument.